Robin had been warned that the foaling season would be hard work, but quite how hard he could scarcely have imagined. Hardly a night passed in which one or other of the boys didn't have to stay up with a mare because her time was close. It would often be a false alarm. Alfred fared the worst of all. He had looked after the pregnant mares all winter long. No one knew them as well as he did, and no one could tell better whether a mare might foal the following night. Robin, with his special aptitude for reassuring a troubled horse, was called upon night after night to attend the births. Quiet, bloody affairs, often taking hours, but for all that, reassuringly normal and undramatic. Sometimes when a mare got scared, she could become unpredictable. But Robin would kneel in the straw and hold her head, and she would become as soft as a lamb in his drowsy caress. There were times when Robin wouldn't return to his bed until just before sunrise, only to be woken again without mercy a few minutes later to attend yet another emergency. It was in the middle of all this hustle and bustle that Warringham's annual horse market was held. Robin thought it was madness to hold the auction during foaling time, but that was the tradition. Every year, without fail, 1 week after Easter. It was a grand event, whose reputation had spread far and wide, attracting knights from all over the country. Yet, when the big day arrived, Robin discovered that it didn't really disturb the routine at the stud farm all that much. There was a fair down in the village, and a great banquet at the castle. But for the grooms, it began as a working day like any other. The only real difference was that this morning they had an audience. It was a fine spring Saturday. The Medway had been a torrent in recent weeks, as the snow on the hills had melted. The sun had found its strength at last, and the trees and hedgerows were tentatively unfurling their first green leaves. A large crowd had gathered by the time the boys rode the first group of young war horses out to the training ground. The riders had polished their boots for the occasion. The stallions themselves were immaculately groomed, and had submitted with stoic composure to the indignity of wearing colourful ribbons in their manes. Around the fence stood noblemen and women in grand array, which left little doubt as to their wealth, all watching with keen interest as the boys took the horses through their paces under Conrad's instruction. Knights leaned against the fences in twos or threes and debated the merits of this or that animal. They went through the same procedure with the second group of horses, and then the third. After lunch came a change to the daily routine. Instead of attending to their usual afternoon chores, the boys brought the horses one by one up to the castle, where a little display ring had been set up in the courtyard for the auction itself. The place was heaving with people. Knights, ladies, servants, squires, travelling merchants, jugglers, musicians, pickpockets and swindlers. Those who were interested in buying formed a circle around the auction ground, and as each lot was announced, a groom would lead the horse forward and hold his bridle, while the steward, Gerard Fitzalan, took the bids. Conrad was at hand throughout to offer information and answer questions. The whole thing lasted several hours, the boys making trips back to the stables to collect each of their charges in turn. When Robin entered the courtyard for the third and final time, it was with his beloved Argus. With a heavy heart, he led the beautiful stallion towards the sales ring. But before he got there, Conrad detached himself from the crowd and approached him.
You can take Argus round to the castle stables, Robin. He's not being sold.
What?
The Earl's decided to keep him. He just told me.
Why?
He wants to ride him himself at the tournament. And if he does well, he'll probably come back here for breeding.
Did you hear that, you old croc? Turns out the Earl can't bear to part with you either.
He told me it would be folly to sell the best horse of the year. And he's right.
I can't believe it.
You won't see so much of him from now on, lad.
I know that, but I'm still glad he's staying.
Oh, you're a bloody softy, that's what you are.
Yes, Conrad.
Go on, show him to his new quarters, and then get yourself off to the fair. The others are on their way down already.
Thanks, Conrad.
Robin led Argus around to the castle stables and was just about to lead him into an empty stall when a familiar figure stepped in front of them.
Give him to me, Mortimer. Oh, you haven't heard? My father said I could have him. So, you see, he's mine now. Give me the reins. Here. You don't like that, do you? Come on, groom. Help me into the saddle.
Robin linked his fingers and bent forward. Mortimer placed a boot into his hands, and Robin hauled him up into the saddle. Mortimer picked up the reins and pulled Argus's head around with a sharp jerk. He rode to the gate and across the drawbridge at a walk. Then he jabbed his spurs into the horse's sides, and Argus carried him away across the hill at a flying gallop. Robin followed them slowly out of the courtyard, watched the rapidly diminishing horse and rider racing towards the distant forest. And then he turned away with a sigh and started making his way down to the village. The Warringham Horse Fair was the biggest event of the village year. Traders and showmen came from far and wide. In the square, in every alley, and along the meadows by the river, they had set up their stands in ramshackle rows and offered their goods for sale. Fabrics and tools, pots, ploughs, seeds, chickens, geese, cattle, and pigs, herbs and spices, remedies for toothache, gout and hair loss, juniper spirit and brandy, belt buckles and knives, stews of mutton and beef, beer, wine and cider. The air was filled with the laughter of children, the haggling of farmers' wives, the cries of merchants extolling the quality of their goods, and all sorts of exotic aromas, some delicious, some disgusting. Robin dived into the throng, bought a piece of ginger cake from a burly baker's wife, and strolled along the rows of stalls in search of a familiar face. He reached the village square, where the squeeze of the crowd was tightest. Here there was another auction ring where horses were sold, but these were not animals bred and trained for war. Here you could buy coarse-limbed farm nags, mules and donkeys, and the sort of sturdy horses that could be afforded by the richer farmers, the poorer country aristocrats and travelling merchants. Most of the business here was conducted in shillings, although one of the better riding horses might even fetch as much as a pound. It was a far cry from the war horses up at the castle, which had commanded prices in excess of £100 apiece, as much as a carpenter could earn in 20 years. The biggest attraction at this year's fair, however, was not the horse market. It was the lion. A dense tangle of people had crowded to see this exotic wonder, and it took Robin several minutes of squeezing his way through before he even fathomed what it was that everyone was so eager to see. The lion was a giant. His saffron fur looked a little moth-eaten, and his noble head was surrounded by a huge shaggy mane. When he narrowed his eyes, his face took on a sly, dangerous look. Robin was fascinated. He had seen pictures of lions in manuscripts at the Abbey, but none of them lived up to the reality. He was glad to see that the animal was locked in a secure cage, but less happy that the poor creature had so little room. The cage stood on a low wooden cart, and it seemed to have been built around the lion, so tight was the fit. Every time the mighty beast moved, its flanks bumped against the thick iron bars. When Robin finally made it to the front of the crowd, he bumped into Isaac and Agnes.
There you are.
We wondered where you'd got to. I had to stay behind. August was the last one, and he wasn't sold after all.
Why not?
Geoffrey wants to keep him.
Sensible man. I'd have done the same if I were him.
Do you want to try a bit of this ginger cake?
Ooh, thanks.
I didn't mean half of it.
Oh, go on, Agus. You have the rest.
Oh, very noble of you, brother dear.
Well, why not? He can afford it now. Conrad will be getting a tidy little sum from Geoffrey for giving up his share of the proceeds on Argus. And Conrad will be bound to give some of it to Robin.
Seriously?
Oh, yes. You're a made man. In fact, you could buy us all a beer right now. What do you say?
The Lion Keeper, a muscular rogue with mean piggy eyes and a low forehead, picked up an iron bar from the ground, struck it through the bars of the cage, and poked at the lion. The animal recoiled, causing the cart to sway dangerously.
Don't be alarmed, ladies and gentlemen. He's quite safe. Roll up, and see the king of the beasts. All the way from darkest Africa. Go on, you mangy old brute, give him a roar. Yeah! Yeah!
Oh, it's awful. That poor creature. Isaac, let's get away from here.
Whatever you say, Duchess. Are you coming, Robin?
As long as I'm not disturbing you two.
Disturbing? What are you talking about?
They left the unfortunate lion with his crowd of spectators and headed for one of the beer stalls. Robin bought 3 mugs of spicy sweet ale and handed them round. Agnes drank thirstily and looked around with sparkling eyes.
Where to now?
There's cockfighting over at the forge.
Oh, definitely not, thank you.
No, definitely not. I agree. What do you fancy?
Well, there's a cart just over the way selling herbs and spices. Let's pop over there for a bit. Cecily asked me to look out for a few things.
Oh, great.
Cecily's shopping list turned out to be a long one. They spent almost an hour at the stall, buying all manner of unusual herbs and powders. The stallholder was delighted to have found such a good customer, but Agnes was no pushover. She bargained relentlessly, counting out coins one by one from the little bag she carried at her belt, all the while loading up her 2 companions with a multitude of packages, bundles and earthen pots. They were happy to help, enjoying the warm sunshine, the colourful bustle all around, and the pleasantly fuzzy feeling brought on by the cheap beer. Finally, Agnes had everything she wanted. They stopped at another stall, where a small dark woman was selling colourful ribbons and scarves. Agnes let her gaze wander across the display of pretty things, smiling wistfully. Isaac glanced around furtively to make sure no one was watching him. Then he stepped up behind her.
Would you like one of those ribbons?
Oh, no. It's just frippery.
I could buy you that one.
No, Isaac, you can't.
Why not? Go on, say yes. It looked lovely in your hair.
But, Isaac, I... Robin? Robin! For heaven's sake, what's wrong?
Isaac heard the commotion and spun around. Robin was standing a few paces away from them, motionless, his arms dangling powerlessly by his sides. Everything he had been carrying for Agnes lay scattered on the ground. One of the little jugs was broken. His face had turned white as snow, and his haunted eyes seemed to be staring into a void. The passing crowd was giving him a wide berth, and Isaac noticed a few curious and even suspicious glances being exchanged. He grabbed Robin by the arm and shook him hard. Robin didn't react, didn't even seem to notice. Agnes felt her throat tighten in fear.
Isaac, what's wrong with him?
I don't know, but we've got to get him out of here. He just won't move. He's like a statue.
Oh, his hands are cold as ice. Robin! Can you hear me?
Robin wanted to answer her, but he couldn't. At that moment, he was master of neither his body nor his spirit. Something seemed to have possessed him. Not so much an intrusion from without, more a kind of state of mind. That familiar penetrating hum he'd heard before was in his ears again, and that throbbing between his temples. Suddenly, he felt overwhelmed by a helpless, miserable horror that consumed his being and blotted out the world around him. Robin closed his eyes, his knees buckled, and he silently collapsed to the ground. And that was the end of it. He opened his eyes, blinked, and slowly sat up.
Robin!
Come on, Robin. Up you get. Here, take my hand.
Oh, Agnes, you're shopping. I dropped everything. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Doesn't matter now.
Come on, let's get you out of here.
Agnes gathered up her parcels and packages from the ground, and together they led Robin out of the crowd and over the bridge to the relative peace and quiet of the opposite riverbank. There the three of them sat down in the grass. Robin gazed into the water, threw a few pebbles in, and tried to collect his thoughts.
What was that?
I don't know.
Do you feel ill?
No.
It was...
Agnes, please, let's just talk about something else, can we?
I don't understand you.
That makes two of us.
Shall we maybe go for another little walk, Agnes?
Good idea. See you later, Robin.
Robin nodded silently, his hand absently groping for new stones. Later, much later, he would find out that Agnes and Isaac had strolled back to the haberdasher's stall, where, after much debate, Isaac bought her that pretty blue ribbon. But for now, Robin remained where he was, sitting by the water, his chin in his hand, waiting for the bad news that he somehow knew was coming. He wasn't surprised when, a little later, he saw Conrad on the opposite side of the river, moving through the crowd with a grimly set face. Reaching the bridge, Conrad stopped, leaned his hands on the parapet, and scanned the crowd with keen eyes. As soon as he spotted Robin, he ran across the bridge and rushed towards him.
Robin!
It's August, isn't it?
How did you know?
Just tell me what's happened.
You're not here. Come on, let's go.
Conrad! What's happened? Conrad!
Mortimer.
He took August away from me before I could get him to the stable. He said it was a present for his father.
Seems he was. Damn it, how blind a man can be when he looks at his own child. Mortimer turned up at the castle a little while ago, on foot. He says they fell out by the White Rock. He's not harmed, but Argus apparently couldn't get up, so Mortimer left him there. I'm going to ride over now. I'd be on my way already, but Maria said I'd take you with me. You want to come, Robin?
Of course I do.
You understand what I'm probably going to have to do?
Yes.
The sun was already low, and the warm spring afternoon was coming to an end. The forest was thick with shadows. Robin rode with his head down, scarcely aware of his surroundings. He just let his horse follow Conrad's. Everything seemed unreal. The trees around him, the muffled fall of the hooves on the forest path, the chorus of birds. It all became a blur, until eventually Conrad stopped and Robin looked up. They had arrived at the White Rock. Robin hadn't even noticed when they'd left the forest, but now the trees were behind them, and ahead the twisted monolith rose like the finger of a giant. Behind it was spread the glorious view into the valley. But Robin had no eyes for that. At the edge of the clearing, under an old chestnut tree, lay Argus. He was on his side, his ribcage shivering as it rose and fell laboriously. Robin leapt out of his saddle and was with him before Conrad had even dismounted. He knelt in the grass by that great, handsome head and took it in his hands.
I'm here, old friend. What's happened to you, eh?
Argus began to swing his head back and forth. Robin knew he was trying to create the momentum to get up, but something was very wrong. Argus got a little way up, but as soon as his hindquarters took any weight, he gave way and subsided back to the ground. He snorted restlessly. Robin ran his right hand over the nostrils while his left supported the head. He looked at Conrad, who was squatting behind the horse and gently palpating the hind left leg with both hands. Finally, he let his hands drop, and he nodded.
It's broken, Robin.
Yes.
Kneel behind his neck, Robin. Take his head and put it in your lap. Stretch it back for me, and keep stroking him.
Conrad's voice was quiet and sober, as it always was when he gave instructions. Robin felt the tears pricking behind his eyes. Pull yourself together, he thought desperately. Don't let Argus know what's happening. He lifted his hands, unsure whether he could go through with this, but his hands obeyed. Gently he took Argus's head into his lap. Conrad stood behind him and drew the long, dark dagger from the sheath he was wearing on his belt.
Close your eyes, Robin.
Robin's eyes closed by themselves. He felt but didn't see Conrad behind him, bending over the long, stretched-out neck. And he heard but didn't see the dagger cutting through the artery. Then Conrad yanked back his arm in a swift movement, escaping the thick fountain of blood that coursed from the wound. Robin felt Argus's head rearing up. His death struggle lasted a long time, because there is a lot of blood in a horse. But he didn't make a sound. His voice was choked and silenced by the blood which flowed inside him. In his primal fear of death, Argus made one last futile effort to stand up and flee. Then a shudder ran through his great body, and it was over. Robin opened his eyes and let go of the head. The trunk of the chestnut tree and a great patch of the grass below Argus were stained red. He had never seen so much blood. The huge body lay still. The coat was already growing dull, the one visible eye half open and milky. Robin got slowly to his feet, looked down at his dead companion, and let the hot tears run silently down his face. The valley below was already in the shade when Conrad finally put his hand on Robin's shoulder.
Come on, my boy.
Yeah.
We have to get back. It's getting dark, Robin.
How did it happen? Here of all places. Obstacles. A good part.
It can happen in the strangest places.
I don't understand it. Argus was so light-footed. Hector's the one forever stumbling over his own feet. But Argus?
There's no point worrying about it now.
Suppose not.
Come on, boy, up on your horse.
You're hiding something from me, aren't you?
Nonsense.
What are you so angry about?
Robin, I'd really like to ride home now, with you or without you.
Tell me the truth, Conrad.
I beg your pardon.
Please.
You're imagining things, boy. You're upset. So am I. It's always horrible when something like this happens, but it does happen.
For no reason?
There's always a reason. You know the way Mortimer treats horses. They always come back with bloody mouths and scarred flanks. He treats them badly and he rides them to exhaustion, and tired horses stumble.
You're still not telling me the truth.
Robin, that's the second time. You'd better not say that again.
You're not telling me the truth!
You're asking for a thick ear.
Go ahead. I don't care.
You should have a little more respect for me, you know. Better for both of us.
I have the greatest respect for you, Conrad.
You're calling me a liar.
No, I said you weren't telling me the truth. That's not the same thing. Why don't you just tell me what you know? Is it really too much to ask?
If I did know something, as you seem to be so convinced that I do, what would be the point of telling you? Argus is dead. There's nothing that can be done about it.
No, but I'd feel better if I knew how it happened.
No, Robin, you wouldn't.
The last light was fading, but Robin could still see Conrad's face. And what he saw there now almost made his heart stop beating.
You think Mortimer...
Dear God in heaven, Robin, what must I do to shut you up?
Knock me unconscious.
I've a good mind to do just that.
You mean he did it on purpose? How? I mean, how did he do it? You can't just break a horse's leg, can you?
Nothing easier if you know how. And if you're cruel enough.
How?
By putting tension on the joint and then hitting it with a club.
For a moment, Robin thought he was going to throw up. He turned around and looked back at the place where Argus lay. Conrad stepped up to him and pointed to the chestnut tree.
He'll have put a noose around the hind hoof and tied the end of the rope to the tree. Then dragged him forward until the leg was bent backwards. He probably tied the reins to the rock and then...
No! You sure?
Yes. I saw where the blow had injured the skin above the knee joint. A wound like that couldn't have formed in any other way. There's no doubt about it.
It's my fault. He knew I loved Argus. He did it to hurt me. Because he hates me.
Yes, that's probably why he did it. But that doesn't make it your fault.
That's why you wouldn't tell me, isn't it?
I didn't want you to blame yourself. And I didn't want things between the two of you to get any worse. So yes, I thought it would be better if you didn't know anything about it.
Are you going to tell Geoffrey?
What for?
So it doesn't happen again.
It won't make any difference whether I tell Geoffrey or not, Robin. You know as well as I do that he knows what Mortimer is like, but he still lets him get away with anything. He's a weak man, at least in that respect. And no matter what he does, nothing's ever going to change Mortimer.
Robin looked up at Conrad and smiled a faint, cold smile. His nose, slightly crooked now, gave him a rakish, almost dangerous expression. He was still only 13 years old. But in his face there was little left of the young rascal who had run away from the abbey 6 months ago and found his way home to Warringham.
You're right, Conrad. Nothing's ever going to change Mortimer. One of these days, I'm probably going to have to kill him.
Passed by. One April afternoon in 1366, two strapping young fellows of 18 were walking across the meadow towards the Warringham stables. Isaac and Robin were now fully grown men, in some respects at least.
Honestly, Robin, the way old Gerard was carrying on, you'd have thought we'd stolen the Holy Grail. It was only a harmless prank.
Oh, come on. We got off lightly. Sixpence fine. And he did have a point. No matter how much the bailiff deserves it, it's not really on to pour horse piss into his beer barrel.
That was the best one you've come up with in ages. I've never laughed so much. The look on his face when he drank it. Oh, wonderful. Still, good to be heading back. I'm always happy to have the castle behind me, the monk's head under my feet, and the stables coming into view.
Me too. You're right, though. The fun was worth the fine.
Gerard's always accusing us of things we didn't do, so it's only fair that we get to be actual criminals from time to time.
He probably licks Mortimer's boots when nobody's watching.
Once a month, Gerard FitzAlan, the steward, chaired the local assembly at Warringham Castle. Most of the hearings related to trivial matters. Disputes between neighbours, lease arrears, serfs malingering or neglecting their sockage. In short, nothing that concerned the stud farm at all. Nonetheless, the bailiff frequently summoned Isaac or Robin, or more often both of them, to answer for actual or invented misdemeanours. And just as frequently the steward and his tame jurors, 12 village men, sentenced them and imposed fines. There hadn't been a shred of evidence that Robin and Isaac were the violators of the bailiff's beer barrel, but nobody else was in the frame. Everyone in Warringham knew they were the culprits.
Hot today.
If it stays this way into the summer, we'll have another bad harvest. And then we really won't have anything left to eat.
It was only April, so Isaac's concern was premature. Easter and the annual horse market were only just behind them. It was impossible to predict what the weather might have in store for the summer.
Just wait. Next week it'll rain cats and dogs.
I hope so. I ate more nuts last winter than a man can handle.
We made it through that one, and we'll make it through another if we have to.
Always assuming the plague doesn't come back.
Too early. Agnes says every 7 years.
If you ask me, that's just a herb wife's tale.
4 winters ago, the plague had come back to Warringham and exacted a terrible toll. Many had succumbed to the swollen, stinking lumps and the final feverish delirium. In the village, they perished like cattle, especially the children, the little ones who had not been born at the time of the last visitation. For them, the danger was greatest. But many of the older generation had been taken too, and the roll call was a sad one. It included Henry, Maria's father, Frederick, the kindly saddler who had made Robin his first pair of boots, and old Cecily, the village midwife. As always, the plague struck at random. Nobody was safe. At the stud farm, the brothers, Cedric and John, had died on the same night. It was said that in Canterbury they were digging mass graves once again. Mass graves for children. The healthy had shut themselves up in their houses for fear of being infected by the clouds of bad air which were thought to carry the plague. It was believed that the night air was particularly dangerous. Those who ventured out covered their faces and carried a torch to burn away the poisonous fumes. Many of the sick died alone, for nobody dared come near them. They lay for days and nights in their own excrement, mad with thirst, until death finally released them. Since the plague had first ravaged England almost 20 years before, it had never entirely gone away, flaring up again every few years. Many thought it was the work of Satan. Flagellants roamed the country, always in groups of 30, emaciated men with pale faces beneath pointed hoods, who scourged themselves and prophesied the end of the world. Wandering mendicants preached that the plague was a punishment of God, which he would keep on sending until the people repented, or until the king ended his godless war. That particular outcome was highly unlikely. The war on the continent continued to drag on indecisively. King John II of France had been a prisoner in England for years. Treated as an honoured guest, he travelled the country with the English court, always at King Edward's side, accorded every liberty but liberty itself. Some said that he hadn't made any great effort to scrape together his ransom, and even that he didn't want to go home at all. But this was ignorant talk. The French king's efforts to collect the agreed ransom had left his people impoverished. But still, he could not raise the massive sum of 3 million crowns. And when his captive son Louis, the guarantor of his release, fled from England, good faith and honour compelled John to return as a prisoner once more. He had died in London 2 years ago. The new king of France, his son Charles, was a fine general and widely regarded as a wise man. The peaceful outcomes that had once been hoped for, first after the Battle of Poitiers, and later after the Treaty of Bretigny, had evaporated. News of the war seldom reached Warringham, where its only real impact was the steady increase in taxes. That, and the regular visits by men from the king who came to persuade young boys to join the troops, making glamorous promises or gruesome threats. Some local youngsters left voluntarily, spurred on by the notion that they could escape poverty and make their fortune at war. Most of them were never heard of again. Isaac and Robin crossed the paddock and came to the stables of the two-year-olds, where the new residents stuck their heads out of their stalls curiously. Robin stopped by the door of a lean chestnut colt with a magnificent white blaze. Casting a surreptitious glance over his shoulder, he produced an apple and held it out to the horse.
Here you are, midget. Now perhaps you can finally start growing.
Better not let Stephen see that.
Stephen knows as much about a young horse's nutritional needs as Cupid here knows about astronomy. He doesn't give a damn. All he thinks about is the feed bill.
And are you going to be sharing these interesting opinions with Stephen?
Funnily enough, no. In spite of everything, I quite enjoy my miserable existence.
Well, I've got one of last year's apples here too. And I am certainly not sharing it with our four-legged darlings, as wrinkled as it may be. You call your existence miserable? I wouldn't say that. Look at you. You're the foreman in all but name these days, aren't you?
If I am, I'm as poor as a church mouse with it.
Who isn't? Seriously, though, if Stephen was hit by lightning tomorrow, Conrad probably wouldn't even notice.
Isaac was exaggerating, of course. Stephen was still Conrad's right-hand man and still enjoyed his full confidence. But Isaac was right that things had changed at the stud farm. Some time ago, Robin had been promoted from caring for the two-year-olds. His duties now extended to all areas of breeding, and that included keeping the books. Conrad had always wanted the breeding program to be managed independently. But before Robin's arrival, that hadn't been possible because there was nobody around who could read and write. Robin's arrival had changed all that, and he had now become an accomplished bookkeeper. But administrative tasks only occupied a small part of his working day. He took care of the mares as well as the studs, and he spent much of his time breaking in the new blood, a job which had once been the exclusive preserve of Conrad and Stephen. Robin's special gift was particularly valuable here. Over the last 5 years, he had learned to control it and to harness it to his needs. It rarely crept up and ambushed him as it once had. He no longer wondered what it was or where it had come from or why it had come to him. Always careful not to flaunt it to others, he employed it to master the difficult art of imposing his will on the young colts without breaking theirs. He could tame even the wildest and most stubborn of them with a grace that seemed almost effortless. Stephen watched his success with envy, Conrad with benevolence and an almost paternal pride. This year, Robin's favourite was a diminutive young colt called Cupid, and he gently pulled him by the ear.
What are we going to do with you, eh? When are you going to grow big enough for that dragon slayer heart of yours?
Oh, he'll grow. Sooner or later they all grow.
Remind me, who's responsible for him?
I am.
Oh, good. Well, here you are then, you little monster. Have another apple.
Honestly, Robin, he's bony, this one. And he runs about as smoothly as a cart with square wheels. Stubborn as a mule, and he's got a temper too. One end bites, the other end kicks. I'm covered in bruises. What on earth do you see in him?
Trust me, he's the smartest of the lot, and he'll be very fast.
Well, if you say so, it must be true. By the way, where's Agnes? I haven't seen her in days.
I think she's with Helen.
God, yes, of course. I forgot.
Stephen's wife was expecting her fourth child. Her previous three had all been difficult births, and this one was proving no different. Agnes had been with her since daybreak, and she had told Robin that it might take all night. Robin, who had lived with Agnes in the little house in the village since Cecily's death, was accustomed to his sister's not coming home until dawn. For a midwife, such hours were quite normal. Things rarely went as smoothly as they had recently with Maria, who had given birth to a healthy girl on the day of the horse market. At last, there was new blood in the equerry's house. Throughout the months of pregnancy, Conrad had been nervous and irritable, and when the time came, Maria had waited until he went up to the castle for the auction before sending for Agnes. And by the time he came home, their daughter had already been born. Conrad was overjoyed. He had bought Robin and Isaac a cup of good wine at the fair, and they had drunk to the happiness of little Judith.
Oh, I hope there's at least one night this week when no one gives birth.
I can't understand you. Why Agnes, of all people?
That's a really stupid question.
Maybe, but she's quite convinced that you're our brother, so she's never going...
Yeah, I know. You don't have to keep spelling it out for me.
I'm sorry.
It's just an excuse, anyway. She just doesn't want me.
Isaac.
Do you think we're brothers?
Yes, I do.
Oh, you're just backing her up, because you don't think I'm good enough for her.
Look, I can't help believing it. Yes, there's a good chance I'm wrong, but there's an even better chance that I'm right. And what then, Isaac? What if you're actually brother and sister? Incest is really the most terrible of all sins.
Didn't you tell me that story about the Volsung? What were their names again? Sigmund and Sieglind?
That's just a story.
Damn it. I wish I'd been born a horse. Then it wouldn't matter. It's a fine life being a stallion. You can have them all and you don't have to care for any of them.
What do you say to getting back to work?
I suppose.
The other grooms had already started the evening round. Isaac joined them, mucking out and feeding, under Stephen's critical gaze as always. Robin attended to the yearlings as he did each evening, supervising the work and lending a hand. It was getting dark by the time they were finished. Robin and Isaac had excused themselves from dinner. They found it best to give Conrad a wide berth on local assembly days. They were planning instead to have something to eat at the tavern later. And something to drink. As dusk fell, they went back to the two-year-olds.
Have you heard Geoffrey's going back to Windsor again?
Again? What the hell does he do there?
You should know better than me.
Not really. My old man didn't think very highly of court life and politics. He always did his best to avoid it, and he detested Parliament. He was a soldier.
Well, apparently, Geoffrey's different. He's been going more and more often.
Yeah, leaving the land and the castle in the hands of our friend Mortimer.
Land and castle and people. Hey, up. Talk of a devil. Don't look now, but here comes the bastard. In the company of a lady, if you please.
Mortimer had grown to be a handsome young man. He was as tall as Robin and Isaac, and his physical training had made his shoulders wide and strong. He was slender and agile, his face finely featured. Robin had to admit that Mortimer was good-looking, at least if you didn't look too closely. The eyes told a different story. With him today was a young woman they'd never seen before, hardly more than a girl. She was wrapped in a dark blue cloak, but her elegant bearing and movement spoke of a slender, well-shaped body. Her head was uncovered, and a cascade of long, dark curls surrounded her pretty face.
Girlfriend?
God knows.
And here, dear cousin, is where we keep the two-year-old stallions who'll be trained as war horses over the coming year.
They strolled alongside the stables, Mortimer's dear cousin peering through each door with delight. At length, they stopped at Cupid's stall.
Oh, isn't this one sweet?
What are you doing here? Haven't you got work to do?
Well, what are you waiting for? Go on, get out of here.
Isaac turned away. Robin hesitated for a moment. He looked at the dark-haired girl. She had leant her arms on the stable door and was looking inside. Suddenly she turned her head and looked back towards Robin, pointing at the little colt.
What's this one called?
Cupid.
Oh, what a lovely name. And he looks like a proper little heartbreaker too.
Robin found himself blushing. He was grateful for the dim twilight. Hopefully the girl hadn't noticed. She straightened up, turned to him, and smiled. Her teeth were even and gorgeously white. He felt as if Cupid had lived up to his name and shot an arrow into his chest. Over the next few days, Robin kept his ear to the ground and found out all he could about the girl. She was the daughter of Lady Matilda's sister, and her name was Alice Perrers. She had been raised in a convent for a few years and had come to Warringham Castle to keep her aunt company for a while. It was rumoured that Lady Matilda was now suffering from the vapours. It was also rumoured that Lady Matilda had grown increasingly fond of wine, particularly since the plague had returned. No one could blame her. She had already lost 2 children to the plague. The latest wave had passed her family by, but it had left her shaken all the same. It had left everyone shaken, but some handled it better than others. Alice, it was said, had come to help banish her black thoughts, and according to the maids at the castle, she was well suited to the task. She was unfailingly light and cheerful. Her laughter, they said, rang through the corridors of the castle. Robin tried to imagine her laughter. It wasn't hard to do. In his mind's eye, he pictured her full lips parting. He saw the little dimples at the corners of her mouth and the glow in her dark eyes. He heard the bright melodic sound of her voice. Yes, it was fair to say that Alice had made an impact on Robin. He began to find excuses to spend every free minute at the castle, pretending he was needed at the stables, hoping to catch a glimpse of her. But it was all in vain. Alice never appeared. So he had to make do with imagining her. And he did. Day after day. All day long.
Robin? Robin!
Hmm? What?
How long are you going to stand there just staring into space? Didn't I tell you to take the mares and foals to the southern paddock?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I forgot. I'll do it now.
I'm sorry. I forgot. For someone who's supposed to be such a clever clogs, you can be a real dope sometimes. Or are you just bone idle?
Yes, Stephen.
Go on, get going. I want to see those mares outside before lunch.
Robin strolled away, taking his time. The mares could be jittery at this time of year, jealously protecting their foals. Some of them left the warm security of the stables only reluctantly, while others could hardly wait to get outside. Taking them in pairs, one bridle in each hand, Robin led them to the protected southern paddock. Their foals trotted along behind them, some still endearingly wobbly on their long legs. As he brought out the final pair, he met Alfred, accompanied by a strong chestnut mare, Dido, who had foaled 4 weeks ago. Dido was sweaty and her head nodded with every step. Alfred had been introducing her to one of the stallions.
And how was the romantic rendezvous?
She was like a blushing virgin. Is her foal still in the stall?
Yes. He didn't want to leave without her. I'll take her over to the paddock if you like. I'm sure you'll want to get to lunch.
Alfred nodded eagerly, tied the mare in front of her stall, opened the door and let out the foal. It snuggled up to its mother immediately.
Thanks, Robin. You'd better hurry up, though, or there'll be nothing left for you.
I'm not hungry. Thanks.
Not hungry? That's quite a talent. Wish that could happen to me sometimes.